Hello, and welcome to Speaking of College of Charleston. Today's episode is a special edition about cannabis legislation in South Carolina. The program is hosted by Washington Post columnist Kathleen Parker. Guest panelists include South Carolina State Senator Tom Davis, Gary Hess, the founder and executive director of the Veterans Alliance for Holistic Alternatives, and Polly's Island attorney Muffy Neese. Now, here's the host of the program, Kathleen Parker.
So I'm Kathleen Parker. I'm a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post, and we're joined by three guests today. We're going to talk about cannabis, why we can't get it passed in the state of South Carolina, why other people are passing medical marijuana laws, and other states are also passing recreational uses. So we're a big smorgasbord of various policies across the land, but we're going to talk primarily today about where we are in South Carolina and what some of the obstacles to just a very simple bill dealing with medical marijuana, where we stand with that. So my guests are, we have Senator Tom Davis, who's been working to get this a bill passed through the South Carolina legislature for how many years?
We got a bill passed in 2014 authorizing cannabis with CBD and trace amounts of THC to be used by epilepsy patients. And so ever since then, 2015 forward, so I guess that's 8 years, I've been working on a full medical bill.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that. I want to hear what the status is and kind of what you think is going to happen next. We also have Gary Hess, who is a veteran. He served in Iraq. And when he came back from Iraq, he had a number of challenges from PTSD and pain and, I think, a serious, you know, brain injury, et cetera. And he found that cannabis was the only thing that worked for him. He tried the pharmaceutical route first, and that created another set of issues. And so he works with veterans trying to help them get access to marijuana, but also has an organization that is you have three organizations, right, Gary?
Yes, ma'am.
Give us that quick synopsis, if you would.
Yeah, so the Veterans Alliance for Holistic Alternatives is the veterans nonprofit about awareness, empowerment, and reform, bringing better healthcare, holistic healthcare options to those in need, not only the veterans who are struggling with trauma, but also the 7 out of 10 Americans who are struggling with trauma. We have a telemedicine access platform where we've brought access or provided access for over 30,000 veterans. I mean, 30,000 Americans, and we have the analytics that support, you know, the medical efficacy, everything that Senator Tom Davis has been saying and has been trying to pass in his own state. And then we also have the Warrior Tribe Medicinal Assembly, which is psychedelic assisted therapies that have been have the research behind them that have just incredible and proven efficacy in the mental health arena. So we're very involved in the suicide and an opioid epidemic that is plaguing not only the veteran community, but the entire country. And we provide real solutions to those in need.
And how long have you been doing all this? How long have you been an activist?
Activist probably since 2016, when I started my own personal journey. And the Veterans Alliance for Holistic Alternatives was created during the COVID era. And we've been serving patients for the last 3 years.
Okay, great. That'll get us started. My third guest here is Muffy Neese. She's not only a friend of mine, but she comes with loaded with information about law enforcement issues, the things that the law enforcement folks are concerned about with any sort of legalization of marijuana, whether it's for medical purposes or any other. As I understand it, even if we did pass a bill, as you've already proposed, Senator, we would be dealing with the most conservative bill anywhere in the country. So it's hardly a revolutionary act if we do move forward with this. But just one last comment. I need to give Muffy's full bio. She's been a prosecutor. She's also been a contract public defender. She's currently a contract public defender in Polly's Island. But more important to some of our listeners, I'm sure, she is a champion angler. don't say, and don't anybody say the word flounder, please. You may fly out of here. And she also recently competed in the world's largest pickleball championship, the U.S. Open, in Naples, Florida. So she's a fanatic no matter what the topic. So I'm sure she'll bring us a lot of good information about. I tried to get some law enforcement individuals to join us, but none of them were willing. I'm not sure why. I asked the head of SLED to come, State Law Enforcement Division. Thank you. Mark Keel, and they didn't get back to me. We had one sheriff lined up to come, but he decided he didn't want to be a part of it either. So I have some comments to make about that later on, but let's just go ahead and get started with back to the senator to find out kind of where we are right now in South Carolina and what are the primary reasons that this bill keeps getting hung up.
Sure. Well, last year, I got the bill passed out of the Senate 28-15. So we had about half of the Republican caucus was in favor of it, and about 75-80% of the Democratic caucus was in favor of it. So a supermajority of South Carolina senators believe it's time to empower doctors and give doctors this tool to help patients, if in that doctor's opinion it could be therapeutic to the patient. So I've been making the case to my colleagues in the Senate for the past 8 years and have persuaded them and brought many people who were opposed to it on board. The House hasn't had the benefit of that debate. They've taken the position that they're not going to take the bill up until the Senate passes something. And it wasn't until last year that I got the Senate to pass something. Unfortunately, once it got over to the House and made its way to the House floor with 3 days to go, one of the opponents of medical cannabis had put 1,000 amendments on the desk to run the clock out. And there was also an argument made that the bill was procedurally out of order because the bill said that sales of cannabis would be subject to a state sales tax to help pay for the program. And there was a point of order raised saying this is a revenue-raising bill, and the state constitution says a revenue-raising bill has to originate in the House. And so it got ruled out of order on procedural grounds. So, but I do think that the bill is poised now to get out of the Senate and over to the House in enough time for it to take up next year. The reason it didn't get taken up this year is, quite frankly, we got stuck behind the abortion debate. And that really sucked all the oxygen out of the room, several weeks of floor debate, so didn't have the opportunity to move it out of the Senate this year. But I do think it'll be one of the first bills up in the Senate in January when we reconvene. I do think it'll be passed out of the Senate relatively quickly, assigned to the House 3M committee, and I look forward to getting it across the finish line next year.
Well, let me ask you something. What is the justification for states passing laws when the federal government still classifies cannabis as a Schedule I drug, along with heroin and LSD?
Yeah, cannabis is, if you know your history, I'm sure you do, the Controlled Substances Act was passed back in 1971 when President Nixon was waging war on the hippies that were out there in the National Mall, and it was determined this was one way to get at them, which was to make marijuana a Schedule I drug, as you say, up there with heroin and other drugs. And the very definition of a Schedule I drug is that it doesn't have any medical efficacy. I mean, that's a definitional phrase. And we know conclusively now, because we've had 39 states that have legalized medical cannabis, we know conclusively that it is therapeutic medicinally. We have peer-reviewed studies, not anecdotal. We have the National Academy of Sciences, the preeminent scientific journal in America, saying there's conclusive proof that cannabis can be therapeutic in areas where conventional pharmaceuticals cannot, particularly in regard to neurological disorders or pain management and things of that nature. But the reason that states have been able to operate in this space is that the Controlled Substances Act typically speaks to federal action and federal laws and what can be done on the federal basis. And there has been case law throughout the country that states that prerogatives in regard to public health remain with the state, that under our federalist system of government, things that touch upon the health and safety and welfare of individuals are still things reserved under the states, primarily through the 10th Amendment. And so that's why so many federal courts have held that the Controlled Substances Act, while it does schedule marijuana as a Schedule I drug at a federal level, did not preempt the field, did not supplant the state's ability to pass laws it believed were in the best interest of its citizens. So that's why you haven't had any of these medical cannabis laws struck down as being violative of the federal law, because there is space for states to act.
Well, I'm told that that President Biden is going to reissue the Cole memo. Is that correct?
Yeah.
The Cole memo basically says the federal government won't mess with you if you're doing legal things in your own state, more or less. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, that was back when President Obama, Attorney General, issued the so-called Cole Memorandum, which was a directive by the Attorney General to all the U.S. attorneys throughout the country, saying you shall not enforce the Controlled Substances Act or this federal law against any state that has legalized cannabis for medical purposes. But as a practical matter, the Congress does that every year anyway in the budget. Every year in the budget, Congress adopts a proviso that says none of the money that's appropriated to the Department of Justice can be used by the Department of Justice to challenge states that have legalized cannabis for medical purposes. So you've already got a federal law, because the proviso in the budget has the force of law. You've got a federal law that essentially supplants the Controlled Substances Act, even to the extent that it had some restrictions on state action. And so, you know, it's across the board. You have the federal government greenlighting this. You've got the Department of Treasury issuing guidance to banks. You have the Internal Revenue Service giving guidance to medical cannabis establishments on how to file their federal taxes. You've got the proviso in the congressional budget every year saying no money appropriated to DOJ can be used to challenge state law. So you've got green lights coming from the federal government. So that really, that whole concern about the supremacy clause and federal law supplanting the state's right to act, you know, doesn't hold water.
Well, in that same vein, I had a little information from someone, I can't say who, that President Biden was also planning to move forward declassifying marijuana as a class one to possibly a class three. Does anyone here know anything about that? Gary, I see you nodding a lot. No? Have you heard anything along those lines?
There's a lot of activity up at the federal level and a consensus among both Republicans and Democrats in D.C. that the federal government ought to act in this space. I mean, it's cognitive dissonance here, where you've got a Controlled Substances Act that says one thing about cannabis, and you've got 39 states that have legalized it for medical purposes. I mean, Congress ought to go ahead and rectify that problem. The thing of it is, although a majority of legislators on both sides of the aisle up there want to do that, It runs into a problem, because whenever a bill like that comes up, talking about the Banking Act or talking about states' right to act, you have Democrats that want to go further. They see this as an opportunity to really do something in this space, and so they end up asking for more things than their Republican colleagues will allow, and so that ends up, you know, the bill crashes on the rocks because of that. So, but I understand, you know, if I'm a Democrat and there's a bill coming along and it's germane to offer these things, recreational use, any things that they want to champion, I can see the temptation to go ahead and try to use that vehicle to push the envelope. I wish what they would do is simply settle for what there's a consensus on now. I think that would rectify a lot of problems. It would rectify that cognitive dissonance that I've talked about, and it would lay the foundation for helping out millions of patients. And so I remain hopeful, Kathleen, but I also understand the politics up there. And every time a bill comes to the floor with Republican support, you've got those like Cory Booker and those on the other side that see that as a vehicle to take things further, and it ends up going nowhere.
Well, Gary, it seems to me one of the best arguments for the federal government getting out of the, declassifying marijuana is that it would then open up all kinds of research that hasn't been able to go forward. You can't go to the NIH and get funding for your research if the federal government says, no, that's an illegal drug in the highest sense of the word. So how have you managed to, I mean, you've referred to some studies that and you also, Senator, studies that have shown the efficacy of these various treatments using medical marijuana. But how do you see research going forward if the feds step out? I mean, what is missing, in other words, that would be most helpful to your cause?
I think, and research is not my wheelhouse, but when you look at the anecdotal evidence, and I speak from personal experience and the number of veterans who continue to use this to not only benefit themselves, but their families, and then also to 7 out of 10 Americans, you know, who experience trauma, the medical efficacy of this plant, just it absolutely cannot be denied, right? Bringing balance, you know, for someone like myself who dealt with traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress, it brought balance, homeostatic balance to my primal functions, the eating, sleeping, digestion, memory, emotional arousal. You know, I was addicted to pharmaceuticals for almost a decade, just a plethora of pharmaceuticals that we're trying to mitigate these symptoms or chronically suppress these symptoms to no avail. And the truth is that I smoked a joint and did everything that the medicines were supposed to do, right? I was forced to become a criminal to access the holistic alternatives that brought balance to my system, that increased the parasympathetic activity, reduced the sympathetic activity of my nervous system, and actually allowed my body to start resting and digesting. So, you know, when we talk about research, and I hear research and the research bills that are brought and the FDA clinical trials, right? That's a very difficult and flawed process.
Well, if you go online, and I did, you know, my son works, is a lobbyist for cannabis out in California, and I interviewed him yesterday while he was sitting in a hot tub, and I thought there's something wrong with this picture, but he said that, you know, that the, if you look up, for example, does cannabis legalization lead to greater youth usage? You can find whatever you want in the terms of research and results. You know, one story says, yes, it does lead to more teen use. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. No, it does. All right, straight down the line, pages and pages and pages. So it's very hard for people to know exactly what is true and what isn't. You know, how do voters, for example, make a decision? How do they find the right kind of information? There was an op-ed in the Washington Post a week or so ago by this Dr. Leanna Wen. She's somebody I respect. She was on TV a lot talking about COVID. You'd recognize her if you saw her face. But she said, you know, cannabis legalization is not something we should be celebrating, and went through a number of reasons why it can be dangerous for certain people. And obviously, it's a drug. And, you know, the comparison to alcohol and cigarette smoking, et cetera, is kind of apples and oranges, I would say. Alcohol has obviously killed a lot of people. I don't know how, they don't have figures on marijuana, because one of the issues with law enforcement, Muffy, is that you can't really, how do you test for intoxication, for lack of a better word, when someone is driving, has a wreck or whatever, how do you find out if they've got marijuana in their blood?
Well, and it's also what's considered an intrusive test at this time, because it would be a blood sample or a urine sample, and that requires going to a hospital facility. And that is one of the pushbacks from law enforcement. A normal DUI would maybe take an hour and a half, 2 hours. And when you start getting into drug recognition experts that would need to be called to the scene if they didn't smell alcohol, but a person to be appeared to be impaired, then they may call another law enforcement agent, an expert, to do their tests, which then they're already stressed. Law enforcement is already stressed, understaffed, and they don't have the resources they need and to be able to take someone to the hospital, sit with them, get these tests. There are some companies who've developed breath tests that will determine someone's consumption within 2 to 3 hours of the test. But otherwise, the test can show someone they aren't accurate for the person's level of impairment at the time they were driving. Because a chronic user could test higher than an occasional user, so the high level of THC in a person's blood is not necessarily indicative that they were impaired at the time they were driving.
So it's still in their bloodstream for a good while.
And it can be 90 days in your hair. It can be 90 days in your blood or urine. It can be 30 days.
Yeah. Well, and regulations concerning, you know, marijuana use and how you do it, like some in California, it's a big hodgepodge, right? They don't have legalization across the state. People see it as you could opt in or out. And 60%, I think, of the counties in California chose not to have legal cannabis in their jurisdictions. So what happens then when you don't have across-the-board legal, as, for example, New Mexico does, is that you empower the black market. Mm-hmm. So the black market in California is, I think, 2 to 1, like $8 billion black market to $4 billion legal.
Across the country, you have cannabis is a $100 billion industry, and only $25 billion of that is regulated. Right, $75 billion is the black market. We just had conversations with the Republican caucus about that a few weeks ago in D.C., and it's creating a lot of security issues for this country. China's getting involved in the black market. They're very deep in the black market. And so the best thing this country can do is to open access to the patient community, can allow access to safe banking, just like every other business, and then regulate an industry that is just an incredible demand because of patient community that is screaming for other options outside of the Western model. Right. These are facts. This is true. This is an issue that is going to affect our country. It's affecting our country a lot deeper than people realize, especially from a national security standpoint.
So what is going on in South Carolina, for example? People can't go and get medical marijuana. So what are they doing? They're shopping the black market?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the problem with that is just like your Delta 8 and your other hemp derived and intoxicants that are now being sold at a cheaper rate. But there's zero regulation. There's zero chain of custody. Right. With a medical cannabis program, you have a chain of custody and accountability from seed to sale, from the time it is planted in the soil to the time that the consumer consumes, pulls it from the shelf. There's a legitimate chain of custody and a scan or a barcode UPC symbol that can tell you exactly what is in it and especially what is not in it, right? Testing for the pesticides and the other harmful chemicals that, we noticed in the vape crisis.
Well, and the taxes are so high, for example, in California. I just happen to know a little bit about California because of my conversations with John. Excuse me. But, the taxes out there are so high that there's still motivation to go to the black market. You know, you can spend $70 on the same amount of marijuana in a dispensary. For the same amount, you can get it for $40 on the street, Yes, Senator.
One of the frustrating things for me is that those who oppose the legalization of medical cannabis to the regulated program that Gary's talking about do not consider what the consequences of failing to do that are. And one of the consequences is physicians will continue to prescribe opioids for something that cannabis can be efficacious, which is much less intrusive, much more efficacious, much less damaging to a person.
Much less addictive.
Much less addictive. And we have an opioid crisis, right? And so we're always sort of wringing our hands up in Columbia, wondering what can we do about this opioid crisis? And, well, one of the things that we can do is empower physicians to provide a less intrusive, more efficacious alternative than opioids, which is what cannabis would be. So I want to make that one point. The second thing is, because cannabis is the only thing that can provide relief in certain circumstances, whether it's PTSD, neurological disorders, people are going to get it any way that they can. And if they can't get it in a regulated, safe way, they're going to get it in an unregulated, unsafe way.
Right.
And that's why you find instances where people are dying because what they buy on the street is laced with fentanyl or laced with something else. I mean, so, for those reasons alone, and the frustrating thing that to me, Kathleen, is those who oppose the legalization of medical cannabis under a very regulated program don't have an answer on how to address those other societal ills that I've just identified. And so, aside from the fact that this bill empowers doctors is the gatekeeper on whether or not somebody has a qualifying condition. Pharmacists have to dispense it, right? So we have professionals at the front end with authorization and on the back end in terms of dispensing. An extremely conservative bill. And they still oppose it. And as I was sharing with Muffy earlier, if law enforcement doesn't get on board and work with me on this socially conservative bill that will help patients in a way that's driven by doctors and pharmacists, demographics are going to take control at some point, and we're going to end up with something in South Carolina that is much more permissive and something that, quite frankly, I don't support. And so, demographics every year is changing on this issue in terms of people's views of marijuana. And so the window of opportunity to come up with something very conservative, very regulated, very controlled, that's closing rapidly. And so there is a consequence to doing nothing, I guess would be my overall point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it seems to me, you know, I remember when President Nixon made, you know, started his little campaign against the pot smokers, which really was about 100% of the students where I attended college in 1971. That was Florida State University, the Berkeley of the South.
And he imposed that ban against the advice of the American Medical Association, against the advice of medical professionals back in 1971, said, don't do this. This is something that has been used historically in a way that helps patients. And nonetheless, he did it, not for medical reasons, but for political and societal reasons. He wanted to stick it to the people that were picketing outside of the mall.
But I want to get to the pot that some people smoked back then was pretty simple by comparison to what's available today. So when you're talking about regulating medical cannabis, I know we're supposed to use the word cannabis and not pot and not marijuana, but
they're all synonymous.
I'm vintage.
Yeah. You're old school. You're OG. Okay.
But as you know, it's not, I don't think we're, you know, getting Acapulco gold and putting it in shoebox lids anymore to get the seeds out. We're smoking or consuming, I should say.
That's a startling degree of familiarity you have with the terminology.
Well, I mean,
Kathleen.
Like I said, it was everywhere. It was everywhere.
It still is.
It was everywhere. I mean, you couldn't, you know, people are complaining now. You walk down the street in New York City, you can smell marijuana smoke. I thought, really? I mean, when you walked anywhere on my campus, it was crazy. Well, it was crazy times, 1971. Come on. So where was I? You see, the memory is, I think it has to do with age, though, not my former exposures. But what about the types of cannabis that we're talking about? And is it regulation the answer to making sure we don't give people, I mean, you don't know always what you're getting, right?
And that's one of the aspects of this bill that I would also point to, Kathleen. I mean, it requires that cannabis not only be tested for safety and the absence of adulterants, like Gary says, but also requires it to be labeled in terms of the ratio of CBD to THC, so that when you're at the pharmaceutical level and you're being dispensed the product by a pharmacist, you can custom fit it to what your particular needs are. And I think it'd be helpful for people to understand, why is cannabis efficacious for some of these medical conditions? And it's because your entire body is made up of an endocannabinoidal system. There are cannabinoids throughout your body.
You have a PhD in pot, right?
Well, after 8 years, you know. But what I'm saying is, a lot of these things that pharmaceuticals are used to address symptoms, cannabis gets to the underlying imbalance in the body as to the endocannabinoidal system that is messed up. So it gets to the root cause, which is why it's efficacious. And so I think people need to understand that your body has got an endocannabinoidal system. And then if it's out of balance, it manifests it with Parkinson's or cerebral palsy or any number of conditions, chronic pain. And the reason cannabis works with PTSD, like Gary can talk about, is that it addresses that underlying disconnect in your endocannabinoidal system and gets to the root of the problem, whereas pharmaceuticals typically treat symptoms. Okay, so, and that's an essential difference here. And since you've had 39 states that have legalized medical cannabis, we have decades of experience with this now. We have peer-reviewed studies. We have medical scientists. You know, it's not anecdotal or narrative anymore. It's fact. It's medical fact, which is why it's not fought any longer by law enforcement or anybody else on the grounds that it's not medically efficacious. They've conceded that point. That ship has sailed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're not really in favor of recreational use, but a lot of people are. And even if they, you know, I think the next step would be that people would be allowed to use cannabis however they want to. I mean, as my son said, we're adults. Everybody needs to be chill and leave us alone. You know?
And that's typically where I come from too, Kathleen. I mean, when I was at Furman, one of the most influential things I ever read was John Stuart Mill's book on liberty. And the premise there was, Mill said, I'll paraphrase, my freedom to swing my arm ends where your nose begins. So that if I do something that affects only myself, government doesn't have any legitimate reason to regulate me. But if I impact and harm somebody else, okay, that's a legitimate pretext for government action. And so that's where I am philosophically. The reason I'm not for recreational use is because when I began this journey 8 years ago, I made a commitment to my colleagues, and I said, I'm going to come up with a bill that is reflective of what I think most South Carolinians want. And what most South Carolinians want, and what poll after poll shows, is that they want to empower doctors, they want to help patients that can benefit, but they don't want recreational use. That's just where South Carolinians are right now. So I feel an obligation to my colleagues to deliver some legislative work product that's consistent with what I told them I was doing 8 years ago.
I'm not against recreational use because of the safety and the efficacy of the plant. But the recreational trends that this nation is chasing right now with the high THC counts and a lack of diversity and the minor cannabinoids and the other phytochemicals that really make the medical benefit of this plant, that is being overshadowed by the recreational push. And so we're chasing these high THC vape products, which lead to anxiety and depression, when we should have access to full plant products with diverse phytochemicals, diversity in the minor cannabinoids, not just the THC and the CBD. So I'm not against the recreational use, right? I would much rather use a medical cannabis product or a cannabis product because of the health benefits rather than drink alcohol, right? It's second nature to go grab a glass of wine or a beer and have 3, 5, 6 every evening. This is accepted within our culture, but sit down and take a few pulls from, a pre-roll or...
Yes, that's the correct term now, I understand. I stayed at a bed and breakfast in California, and they offered pre-rolls to the table. You know, we had this big farm table, and I was quickly instructed that pre-roll is now what we used to call a joint. And I heard this fellow down at the other end of the table go say, "This is the best bed and breakfast I have ever been to." And that was under the program that California allows. You can have 6 female plants or 12 in the case of a couple, and you can share, but you can't sell. So he was sharing his pre-roll. Yeah, do you still take tokes? How does that work? I'm so old now, I don't even know what the vocabulary is, but I am a wino, I'll admit it.
And when you say pre-roll, right, when the stigmas are just, they're so institutional, they're so ingrained in us. THC smoke is bad. Oil CBD is good, right? So that is the general consensus when you talk about cannabis, unless you're talking to a community that has experience with it. And so a simple and very interesting fact with for someone like myself who does have asthma from the chronic stress, from the combat stress. Yeah, so cannabis smoke will actually end an asthma attack in under 2 minutes.
Really? Right?
Smoke it absolutely will. And right, so that's where the education, the empowerment and comes in. It's for those who are against it. Let's sit in a room for a good 30 minutes to an hour and address the facts that are associated with the use of this plant, right? It's not a gateway drug. Childhood sexual trauma is a gateway drug. Domestic abuse is a gateway drug. Pharmaceutical dependency is a gateway drug. Those pharmaceuticals that are pushed on us by the medical providers, because that is the only answer they have right now. Just like Senator Davis was saying, we need the medical community to step in, right? And start providing access. When we look at...
Well, how much opposition is there coming from the pharmaceutical companies? Because I was thinking, you know, the obvious research survey or the research study would be to put people who've been on opioids on cannabis instead and see, you know.
That's been done. I mean, that's been done in double-blind peer-reviewed tests. And we can see, you know, multiple states, there is a direct correlation between the availability of cannabis to address some of these conditions and the number of opioid prescriptions and the number of opioid deaths and the number of people who take opioids, a direct one-to-one comparison. So we know, we're not speculating here. We know as a matter of fact that if you want to decrease the number of opioids being used, or you want to eliminate or reduce opioid deaths, medical cannabis is a way to do that because it gives physicians another tool in their toolbox to address a problem that opioids aren't necessary.
Right. Well,
as someone in the trenches with clients who've suffered of opioid addiction, a lot of them veterans, some of them, you know, high-ranking careers. And they had some injury and got hooked on the opioids. Well, they can't enter our traditional drug court programs because they're using cannabis so that they aren't on the opioids.
And so they've got to be tested, so that eliminates, I see.
Exactly. And it's they're not committing the crimes they were when they were addicted to the opioids. They feel better. They're not in the emergency room all the time, zapping those resources, trying to get more opioids. They're in chronic pain, and the only thing that can alleviate that is cannabis. And yet they can't do that legally. They can't be on probation, and even not in one of these drug court programs, but they can't be on probation and test positive for cannabis, which, again, keeps them working, keeps them from committing other crimes. And a lot of their physicians have said, just do it. It's worth the risk. But it's really not. I mean, you know, from my perspective, no, it's not. But from the physician's perspective of, look, you know, your liver was failing. This was happening as a result of your opioid addiction. And now look where you are.
Let me say this one thing about that, what Muffy just said. I mean, we went through COVID, and a lot of the upstate senators that are in opposition to medical cannabis, they were the first ones saying that what is the CDC doing telling physicians they can't prescribe ivermectin to individuals if that physician believes ivermectin is something that's going to help them? I mean, so they were all for that. They were all for empowering doctors. They were all for medical freedom. They were all for getting government out of the way of the physician-patient relationship. But then you flip it around and you say, well, what if a physician believes that somebody with Parkinson's can benefit from cannabis and can address that neurological disorder? Don't you agree that 170 politicians in Colombia ought not stand in the way of what a doctor thinks of the best interest of that patient, just in the same way as you make the argument that the CDC ought not stand in the way of what a physician believes is in the best interest of somebody with COVID? And they really have no response to that, and because there isn't one.
Well, these are the same people who want to decide when conception occurs.
See, now I knew we were going to have abortion before this thing ran, Kathleen, and you told me before I walked in here we weren't going to talk about zygotes or any of that stuff, and here it comes.
Yeah. Well, it's just a certain mindset, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Well, law enforcement is still, whether it's medical or recreational, obviously recreational will create a heightened issue with this, but law enforcement's, a lot of their arguments, as I talk to them about this issue as we're sitting around waiting for the next case, everything from the canines, what a vital tool for law enforcement, whether it's the border, the airports, court security and whatnot, to know, be able to detect drugs, and now what's going to happen to that? That will absolutely tarnish the credibility of these animals who are alerting on cannabis when it's a passenger who can smoke legally, if it were legal, in the car and the driver's not smoking. That is also a loss of a search tool love.
Well, another wrinkle is a lot of searches if you pull somebody over and you smell marijuana in the car, they can use that as an excuse to search the car, right?
Correct.
So if marijuana is legal, no more searching.
They lose that tool.
But the point of that, Kathleen, is this bill specifically says you can't burn flower, okay? You can't smoke flower. You can't, okay? So that's the thing that typically gives the aroma, okay? You can't do that under this bill because law enforcement, when I went to them and said, what's the one thing you hate most about this bill? And they said, well, it's the fact that you allow as a form of consumption burning a flower. We don't like that. So I took that out. I mean, oils, you have to vape it through oils or use it topically or as a tincture.
Burning a flower. What are we saying here?
It's the thing that's in the joint that you fire up. You can't combust it. You can't burn it. And under this bill, because they didn't want smoking. Law enforcement didn't want smoking. And also you can't smoke it or vape it or do anything in a car either. So if you come up on a car and you smell marijuana, that is still a legitimate reason for them to go in. So,
under this particular bill.
Yeah, no. And again, because this bill, rightly or wrongly, I tried to get consensus over 7-8 years by getting everybody at the table, law enforcement, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, you know, Moms for Action. I tried to get everybody and get all those Venn diagram circles lined up and figure out where the overlap was. And so that's why it became a very conservative bill that, quite frankly, a lot of the grassroots activists don't support this bill anymore because it is so tightly regulated. It is such a medical-only kind of a bill. And my point, again, is if they don't come to the table now and set these parameters, they're going to end up with a bill that has none of these safeguards in it, and a lot of the things that they worry about are going to come to pass because they didn't go ahead and work with me on coming up with something that empowered doctors but drew a bright line against recreational.
So if someone's on a car trip and they need to vape every 2 hours and it's a 5-hour car trip, they are not going to be able to meet their medical needs?
You cannot vape in a car. Wow. And that was because I was trying to be sympathetic to what law enforcement's challenges were.
Can you pull off to a rest stop and vape?
You can pull off to a rest stop, but you cannot be in the vehicle itself. And again, I was sympathetic to the point that you made earlier, quite rightly, Muffy, is that unlike with alcohol, there aren't tests right now on the market that are as reliable to measuring, you know, the blood alcohol content you do with that, but you don't have the same thing with cannabis because cannabis stays in your system, the fatty tissue in your body, for a longer time. And so what you're essentially reduced to in trying to make sure somebody isn't driving under the influence of cannabis are these field sobriety tests and making them come out there and test their motor movements and things of that nature. But I'm willing to sit down, and I've offered with law enforcement saying, look, I recognize this enforcement problem that you're having. Let's figure out how to get you to a point where you feel like you can empower your officers out there to keep the roads safe. And we've come up with a lot of things that I think get them there. And I'm willing to do more. I mean, because technologies are developing all the time. To your point, there is a test now where you can test. But I'm sympathetic to their argument and want to solve that problem for them.
Muffy, and there's another argument for legalization, which has to do with social justice. That it's statistically true that people of color are more often arrested and incarcerated for marijuana use. And a lot of the people that I've talked to out in California, for example, are highly motivated by that idea. In Charleston, you're 6 times more likely to get arrested for cannabis if you're a person of color right now. So how much of a factor is that idea here, or in your experience, Gary, anything there to add?
I agree. We see the same thing down here in southern Louisiana. It's it's obviously a much higher rate.
Yeah.
Well, so it goes to I obviously see that in my practice, and it goes back to, again, some of these folks are meeting their medical needs, and I discussed with Senator Davis that I'm for the recreational use. I mean, that we're just kicking that can down the road for a while when an adult should be able to make a decision as they can with alcohol on something like that as well. And we have to figure out how to have these safety measures just like we did with alcohol and driving and what we could do to keep the road safe. But
well, one thing, I think people who smoke pot are not highly motivated to get in the car and go do something else.
But the collateral effects of a drug conviction for a Schedule 1 are significant. It can affect, it's a Schedule 1, and it can have significant ramifications from loan applications, depend on, you know, if they did the Walmart theory and bought in bulk and had over an ounce and they end up with felonies as a result of trying to meet their needs medically or psychologically, like the person who comes home and has a cocktail, but this person doesn't want to drink. They would rather smoke cannabis. And so the collateral effects of this are crippling our prison systems, our local jail systems, for some someone getting, you know, busted with a marijuana joint, even if they're not in a car, if they're out at some concert and they've got it on them, they miss work or they get fired from their job, then they aren't taking care of their children. And the collateral ripple effects have got to be addressed. All of these are elephants in the room.
Gary, you were looking like you wanted to say something. I can't remember where we were, but I saw you lean forward.
I was talking
about people who smoke pot aren't highly motivated to.
No, that's right, and I want to chime in because that's a misconception, right? Because
things have changed, I'm sure.
The stigmas, right? The stoner. The truth is when I ran out of options, I used cannabis as a performance enhancer. Cannabis was the only thing that got me out of my house and into a vehicle and allowed me to integrate myself back into a functional society. So
I was making a joke.
No, I know, but you never know who's listening. So I just,
that's true. I'm glad you clarified
that. Let me make this point that it may be a bit counterintuitive, Kathleen, but in states that have legalized cannabis for medical purposes, you've actually seen the number of driver impaired accidents go down, driver impaired deaths go down. And that's primarily because alcohol and marijuana are substitute goods. And if somebody is taking marijuana, they are statistically less likely to be consuming alcohol. And it's just empirically true. And the Department of Transportation has done studies on this, that somebody behind the wheel, and I'm not advocating somebody getting behind the wheel high on marijuana, but they are not as reckless as somebody who is behind the wheel drinking alcohol. It just has a different effect on your body, which is why there is a statistically significant difference why you see traffic deaths and traffic accidents go down in states where cannabis is legalized, because they are substitute goods. And it is a bit counterintuitive, because you kind of think, well, if we make marijuana legal, that's going to increase the number of impaired driving incidents. It's not true. It's the absolute opposite.
I think that's an interesting point. If you look at a very simple metric called the heart rate variability, look at the HRV level when you consume alcohol versus cannabis, right? Cannabis, I mean, when you consume alcohol, your heart rate variability, which is the measure of your autonomic nervous system, it goes down significantly, right? The brain and body continue to disconnect. Well, when you consume cannabis, your HRV actually increases because it reduces the chronic stress. It promotes homeostatic balance within our bodies, and it increases your heart rate variability levels. And that is a significant measure of health and well-being. And so A plus B equals C, just like Senator Davis was saying, right? It's reduction of alcohol, reduction of traffic incidents is very, it's similar to the reduction in the opioid prescriptions, right? If you look at the indirect implications of legalization of medical cannabis or recreational cannabis, the answers don't, I mean, the answers are just, they're hard to deny. We're having to come up with ways to prevent this from being legalized in these states, similar to what happened last year, Senator Davis, with the procedural, you know, at the end that pulled it off the table. And so that's where we are. You have 76% of South Carolinians support medical cannabis. That's a big number. And that number, I think, is even higher than that across the United States, right? It's just time to start having real conversations and get rid of and get out of these outdated institutional policies that are driving our healthcare and the world we live in today.
Well, I don't think anyone would want to deny a veteran whatever help cannabis would provide in healing from what they've already been through.
But you'd be wrong about that. There are lots of legislators who would like to deny it.
Well, I don't understand it. I can't even conceive of that. I wonder how many of them served in active duty.
I have a significant number of clients on Suboxone or methadone, which is basically synthetic heroin. And I say that because there's not anything on their bottles that say use caution when operating machinery. But they're given that to keep them off the streets and off the heroin. It's not illegal to drink and drive in South Carolina. It's illegal to drink to the point where you're impaired and cannot operate a dangerous piece of machinery responsibly and with the same care as someone who hasn't partaken. And at some point, they determined it was 08. I think that was under Mark Sanford. there has to be a way that even people who are meeting their needs with medical marijuana, that they can meet their needs and operate a motor vehicle. People are operating it with Suboxone. They're meeting those needs. And we need to figure out, we're sending stuff to Mars. We can do this, but everybody continuing to put their efforts to buck something that benefits Americans is preventing us from trying to explore how we can know what an appropriate level is for someone who is under medical supervision for something they need, but yet they want to go see their mom 5 hours away or whatever. What is a safe level? As you just said, that statistically, the accidents have actually declined.
When you talk about safe levels, that's a difficult situation. The truth is that the numbers they don't go up when it's legalized. The numbers in regards to traffic incidents go down. And when you're talking about someone like myself for a long period of time, use cannabis on a daily basis, right? The density of my receptors change. Therefore, my 0.08 is going to be very different than somebody else's 0.08, right? Because of the density in those receptors change. And so I am not intoxicated, but yes, it will take more of the cannabis to produce the desired effect. So right now we're testing for metabolites in the system, and they're trying to come to market with devices that test for impairment. But there's a lot of headway that really needs to be made in understanding how that fat soluble plant or medicine interacts the pharmacokinetics within our own bodies before we can start implementing these policies.
So what about this? What's the likelihood of Governor McMaster creating a commission on cannabis to decide, kind of create a policy going forward to anticipate the demographic future you've described, but also put those people back down at the table and let's solve this issue once and for all?
Well, I think...
I know that he is a famous drug buster.
He cut his teeth on Operation Lost Trust or Jackpot back in the day, right?
The Gentleman Smugglers.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that back when I was at Furman. I had a roommate that his father was a part of that whole thing. But
it's the largest pot bust in the U.S. history at that point.
Yeah, but Governor McMaster, I think, pretty much showed his hand during the gubernatorial debates with Joe Cunningham. When Joe was arguing in favor of recreational and medical legalization, and when, you know, the time came for Governor McMaster to respond, he talked about how he was against recreational, but he conceded that the case had been made in regard to the medical efficacy and that he could see the argument behind empowering doctors prescribing or authorizing use of cannabis for conditions for which there's empirical proof it could be efficacious. So I think Governor McMaster's already signaled he will sign this bill. And I think that's a complete evolution for him over the years, because as you say, Kathleen, he started out as a U.S. attorney, you know, prosecuting, drug enforcement cases, much in the same way that Chief Keel, you know, came up of age during that time as a narcotics agent. And he's got these experiences that have informed how he views this issue. But Governor McMaster, I think, has shown a remarkable ability to listen to facts and to challenge and change long-held convictions. And I think he's been commended for that.
So the consensus at this right now is that you think this bill will go through in January.
And it'll pass the Senate.
And it'll pass the House? Or?
Well, you know, I would like to think so, Kathleen. We had the votes, and I think Gary was following the vote count in the House a lot more closer than I was, because I was over there working in the Senate. But there were the votes to pass this bill in the House last year. And the only way they could derail it was, A, by putting 1,000 amendments on the desk and running the clock out, or B, challenging it by saying this is a revenue-raising bill, which it clearly wasn't a revenue-raising bill for the general fund. But they went ahead and hung their hat on that procedural ruling. But if it gets to a vote in the House, there are the votes to pass this.
I think some people listening might say that this has been too pro-cannabis. I mean, you've obviously got the legislation on the table. Muffy has seen the way marijuana gets abused and used in the penal system and in social justice issues. And Gary wants to see veterans, of course, get the help they need. So what is... Muffy, maybe you could play devil's advocate. What is your best argument against legalization if you were, say, a SLED agent?
Well, my conversations with law enforcement is how the biggest number one issue that continues to come up is how are they going to effectively enforce driving while impaired? That's the number one issue that they keep repeatedly saying. How are we going to measure someone's level of impairment when they're behind the wheel of what the law considers a dangerous instrument, a vehicle? And I get that. We don't have that in place. Nationwide, we don't have it. There is a company that out of California that has a device, but it's not nationwide. It's still under testing. There's another company in a study out of UCLA trying to work on this same issue. But we need to push forward, and law enforcement should, to me, be saying, well, hey, why can't we develop this? Why can't NASA scientists, instead of just saying, oh, well, because of that, we aren't going to move forward with it. I get that. That is an issue, but it's...
Sounds like it can be resolved somehow.
Exactly.
And can I push back on that a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, right now, you can't drive in a vehicle if you're impaired by pills. You can't drive a vehicle. I mean, and those things, they have the same challenges in regard to measurement and intrusiveness in blood samples just as they would with cannabis. So I quite frankly think that's a disingenuous argument. I want to help them. I want to be sympathetic. But right now, it's already against the law to drive impaired under pills. And so is that a reason for banning pills?
So if somebody's weaving around the road, then you pull them over, you take them,
sure,
put them in jail. And you can decline a blood, an alcohol test.
The one argument that I hear that has the most salience up there is, well, this is a federal law. And, you know, under the Supremacy Clause, federal laws take precedent over state laws. And I don't want to be passing a state law that's in contravention of what Congress has spoke to.
Yeah.
But the response to that, I think, is fairly simple, in that the Controlled Substances Act itself specifically says this is not meant to supplant the state's right to go ahead and pass laws they think are in the best interest of their citizens. And second to that, you've got Congress every year in the budget proviso saying you can't enforce CSA against states that have legalized medical cannabis. So this whole federalist argument about the Supremacy Clause doesn't hold water either. And you know, I think there's a reason, and it's telling that you don't have law enforcement here to answer questions, because quite frankly, Kathleen, every time they prop something up and you knock it down, they scramble around to try to find something else, and they flat run out of arguments. I mean, they used to walk around the State House with buttons that said marijuana is not medicine until the National Academy of Sciences said we have so many peer-reviewed studies that show that it is medicine, they stopped wearing those buttons. They just don't have the arguments anymore, which is telling it's why they're not here.
Right. I agree. Generally, when people don't show up and don't want to talk about an issue, it's because they don't really have anything to say that's going to serve their purpose. So anyway, I want to thank you all. Anything else, Gary, you started to say? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think, right, because that's an argument that comes up in every state is how do we control impaired driving? I'd say the first place to start, let's start in South Carolina. Can you prove that it is a problem? Right. Because this is the argument that just creates the what if. And creates the fear. But can we prove that driving under the influence of cannabis is a significant problem in South Carolina, right? Start right there. And then if we identify it, supported by credible facts, then let's start having a conversation. But to prevent access from a healthcare standpoint for those who are in dire need, especially children with epilepsy, because we can't control someone driving under the influence of cannabis, prove that it's a problem first, and then let's sit at the table. Don't hold up access to those in need.
Right.
Well, there is this one study out of Denmark, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but that shows that like a third of these of young males primarily with schizophrenia also have a what they call marijuana use disorder. So what do we say to things like that? I mean, that's a study.
Well, it's because in South Carolina, in this bill, I'll speak to that, Kathleen, that a doctor has to authorize it. and a doctor can't authorize it unless there is a thorough due diligence to see whether or not somebody has a disposition toward schizophrenia or disposition toward negative mental health consequences. And if that's the case, they can't authorize its use. Okay, so it's true. I mean, any drug can be abused. And to your point earlier, marijuana is a drug. It can be abused. I'm not going to say that it can never be abused. I'm not going to say that it can't enhance and make someone who's schizophrenic even more dangerous to themselves. But that's why in this bill, and I bring it back to this bill, we have a very thorough due diligence process on the front end where a doctor has to go through a patient's medical history, including, you know, disposition toward mental illness, before there can be an authorization. So I can only speak to what this bill tries to address. I've listened for 8 years to every argument that they put up, and that I have sat down in good faith and drafted language to address it. There is nothing in this bill that they can put forward as an objection where I can't point to it and say, I heard you. We addressed it. Next.
Gary, what's the best bill out there for cannabis use for medical purposes?
The one that gets passed.
All right.
You have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And then gain the trust and prove that it's a credible program and allow the patient's voice, move that to the forefront of the conversation. And you're going to see that program expand in the ways that they need to. But Senator Davis just capitalizes on a key point. If you don't do something now, if you don't act now, you're going to lose control of it. And we're starting to see that across the country with the illicit market.
Well, thank you. Thank you, all of you. You've offered so much good information. I hope people listen to this and learn what they need to know to feel more comfortable, you know, going forward about what this really means when we talk about legalization for medical purposes and also for recreational, should that come up. Thank you both here in the studio, and thank you, Gary, for joining us from wherever you are. And congratulations to your son on his kindergarten graduation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of Speaking of College of Charleston with host Kathleen Parker. The guest today, Tom Davis, Gary Huss, and Muffy Neese. You can find episodes of Speaking of College of Charleston on all major podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and leave a review. This episode was produced by Amy Stockwell from the Office of Marketing and Communications, with recording and sound engineering from Jesse Kunz with the Division of Information Technology. Thanks again for listening to Speaking of College of Charleston.